Hello there, and welcome to our regular podcast, The Lawdown, which is a podcast in which we discuss the latest key employment, discrimination, and partnership law related news stories, and we unpack the interesting legal issues behind them. So I am Pooja Dasgupta. I'm an associate at CMRE, and I am joined today by my wonderful colleagues, Beth Howe, partner at CMRE, Winifred Sarfo Jamfi, associate at CMRE, and Yulia Fedorenko, another associate at CMRE. So today we're going to discuss a few stories, starting with the infamous Will Smith and Chris Rock Oscar slap, which I'm sure we'll all have seen going viral on the internet. Secondly, we're going to discuss the tragic pregnancy loss of Cristiano Ronaldo and his partner Georgina Rodriguez. And thirdly, we are going to discuss Partygate, which I don't think I need to probably explain any further, but the kind of issues around that in terms of our wonderful Prime Minister potentially misleading Parliament. So to start with the first story, the Will Smith and Chris Rock Oscar incident. As we'll all know, but briefly to summarise, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences Board of Governors has now banned Will Smith from all its events, including the Oscars, for 10 years after the Best Actor winner slapped Chris Rock, who was presenting on stage at the Academy Awards ceremony after Chris Rock joked about the appearance of Will Smith's wife, Jada Pinkett Smith. So Will Smith has publicly apologised himself and has resigned from the Academy. And the Academy's decision came after its president expedited a board meeting that was scheduled for around the middle of April in light of Smith's voluntary resignation. And in the letter to the board members, the president, David Rubin, said that the AMPAS rules stipulated a 15-day notice to consider suspending a membership, but given that Smith had already resigned, that no longer applied. The Academy issued a statement in which they said that Smith's actions were unacceptable and harmful, and they also apologised for their own handling of the situation during the live broadcast, adding that during the telecast, they felt that they didn't adequately address the situation in the room, and for that they were sorry, and that it was an opportunity for them to set an example for guests, viewers, and the Academy family around the world, and they fell short. They were unprepared for the unprecedented, apparently, according to their statement. So, Winnie, I wondered if I could come to you to kind of discuss your initial takes on what happened at the Oscars, and, you know, the kind of potential interesting legal issues behind it.
Yeah, I think it was quite shocking for, you know, the people that were at the Oscars actually watching what happened, as well as individuals at home, and perhaps they could have potentially been traumatised by the experience. I don't think that the punishment was severe enough. I think a 10-year ban doesn't actually warrant him from receiving an Oscar. He's still able to win an Oscar and be nominated, and he also got to keep his Oscar. So it begs a question as to whether he was really punished, because if he can still win, then does that prevent a future event from happening again, perhaps with a different actor? But I do appreciate that from the experience, he did lose a lot of endorsements and other implications professionally. So that is, I guess, the consequence of his actions. So that could also be classified as a punishment. I think generally, in terms of a situation like that happening in the workplace, generally, employers have a duty to ensure that employees are safe at the workplace, which includes being safe from injury and harm, also from assault and abuse in the workplace. What are your views on that?
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think there's obviously a kind of variety of views on what happened, the reaction to it, the action that was taken by the Academy. It's obviously on such a public platform that the Academy must have been very alive to the fact that this isn't just something that you can deal with kind of softly and on a confidential basis. You have to make quite a public stance and deal with the kind of implications of it going forward. I think in an employment context, I think prevention is always better than cure. That's always what we would say. And in terms of employers taking proactive steps to evaluate their workplace culture before it even potentially gets to that kind of situation. And, you know, if we're thinking about kind of practical takeaways from a kind of similar situation, but in our world, as it were, you know, proactively focusing on how to prevent potential incidents of workplace assault, harassment, misconduct, and whether that's through regularly providing and refreshing training, and, you know, delivering specific training to people, you know, such as managers who might have to kind of deal, they might be first responders to these kinds of incidents. And just generally encouraging a kind of a speak up environment. Obviously, what played out at the Oscars was it was public. You know, everyone could see it, so they had to take formal steps in light of that. But I think even when things happen in a private workplace context, employers should be aware of how they are perceived to be acting and the kind of messages they want to send out to their own workforce and how they want to be managing these situations. And we often obviously deal with, you know, complex workplace investigations, and the tricky thing can be dealing with this quickly, but also appropriately and sensitively. And, you know, if you can't get ahead of the situation, what do you then do? Well, you again, there's that balance between acting quickly, but also kind of taking advice as you need to in terms of the legal issues, the regulatory issues, potentially if you're in a regulated environment, you know, considering where the suspension might be needed. And obviously in the Oscars context, Will Smith kind of got ahead of it in that he resigned, and they didn't need to deal with it kind of immediately because he kind of removed himself from that whole environment. But often that's not the case. You know, somebody's still very much employed, and the employer then needs to think about how do they deal with that day to day in terms of managing the relationship between the person that's raised the allegations and against whom they've raised it, and how can they be together in the same workplace? They might not be able to. And just taking adequate steps to protect the well-being of all the parties that are involved as well, pending kind of detailed, a thorough and detailed investigation. So I think those are the kind of key issues in terms of a workplace, managing the workplace investigation into these types of allegations. Obviously, I think there's a wider point about bystander effect of it all, because what happened at the Oscars was, you know, that played out in front of a lot of people, and appreciate that the context is slightly different in that, you know, audience members probably didn't feel that they could get up and do something about it. But what do you do if that was in an employment context and that happens, you see that happening, what do you do? Well, again, there needs to be specific training that kind of envisages that type of scenario and how you should deal with that scenario and what you should do thereafter, because potentially if you're a bystander and you could have done something to prevent, you know, the situation happening as it did, then you might then have some kind of personal involvement and potentially liability in the situation, where if you'd had training, then it might not be it might not end up like that. So those are kind of my general takes on it. I think there's a lot to unpack from it.
Absolutely. I think the Academy was actually criticised from not removing Will Smith immediately after the incident, and apparently he refused to actually leave, so he was still able to kind of stay at the event right till the end and went on after party after, which...
And went on stage to receive his Oscar, didn't he?
Yes, soon after. Which is completely out of order, really. He should have been removed immediately in a workplace situation.
A workplace situation, I think it's quite difficult to, I mean, I broadly agree with you, but I think you need to make sure that you're not doing anything, you know, you're not prejudging the situation, and that you have the power to remove people from the workplace and you have the power to suspend. So it's, I mean, I think you've got the sort of conflicting interests there of making sure, sort of following due process, making sure you've got the relevant powers, but also protecting the health and safety. And if there's an, if you perceive that there's an immediate risk to the health and safety of someone else, you know, as you might, I mean, it's all, you know, these people weren't employees of the academy and they weren't colleagues in that kind of way. So we're sort of transposing that into the employment scenario. But I think, you know, I think it's a really difficult situation. If a fight breaks out in a workplace, you know, how does an employer react? I think it's very difficult because, your immediate instinct, your right one, is to say, take that person out, take the aggressor out. But, you know, what Chris Rock said was not appropriate either. So, you know, Absolutely. It's, and I'm not defending Will Smith, but, you know, there's a lot of moving parts, aren't there? And I think it is a really difficult one.
Absolutely. It's very difficult when there are multiple offenders, and it's quite tricky to actually investigate because perhaps in a workplace situation, co-workers, they also have a responsibility in terms of accurately reporting what's taking place to facilitate the investigation. What if no one comes forward to actually, you know, explain what they've seen? That could be quite tricky in the employer being able to get to the bottom of that situation.
Yeah, I think there are lots of different factors in play. And I think the situation will obviously be different from one company to the next, or, you know, whatever that setting is. And obviously, as Beth rightly said, we're kind of transposing these issues into an ordinary employment context, but there were various other factors in play for the Oscars, and particularly that it played out so publicly. So yeah, but interesting nonetheless. So I think thank you very much for your takes on that. I think with that, we'll move on to our second topic, which is Cristiano Ronaldo and Georgina Rodriguez's pregnancy loss, and I'll pass over to Beth to summarise what happened in that story.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you've explained it pretty much. So really sadly, Cristiano Ronaldo and his partner were expecting twins, and one of the twins died at birth, and so they were expecting a boy and a girl, and the baby boy unfortunately died during at birth. We don't know exactly what happened, but I think what it flagged up to me, and the reason I wanted to talk about it today, is giving airtime to that kind of issue, bringing that kind of issue to the public attention, and just thinking about how employers manage it. And it's an issue we've discussed previously on the Lawdown, is how employers are managing things like pregnancy loss policies and introducing those kinds of policies, and I would say how welcome that kind of move towards just transparency and openness about these kinds of issues, and actually having those conversations in the workplace and giving people a framework for coming to their employer and saying, actually, I need to take some time off. I think people have often historically suffered those kinds of experiences in silence or not known how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of around bringing those issues into the, you know, raising the profile of you know, these things happen to everybody. Not everybody, but you know what I mean? They happen to a lot of people. They're actually, you know, miscarriages are common. I think it's just sort of, it's a really sad story, but it does a positive thing, which is raise awareness of these kinds of issues. And I think it is something which employers are addressing more and more, which is a really positive step. So I think we were just going to talk about sort of the law around that and what would happen. Again, I mean, we're not commenting on Cristiano Ronaldo's particular contractual situation, but more sort of generally on how that plays out in employment more broadly.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to remember that even though people are, I can only talk for my own kind of personal circle, but I feel that people are maybe talking a bit more about these kinds of issues and I think sharing with at least their friends, maybe not quite at the stage of sharing with colleagues because it can be really difficult. It's still, you know, loss of a baby is still, generally speaking, rarely discussed, you know, even amongst close family and friends. And that can leave parents feeling alienated, unsupported. I saw a statistic that in 2020, there were 2,231 stillbirths and 733 deaths of babies born in 24 weeks in England and Wales, mm-hmm. A rate of 2.7 deaths for every 1,000 live births. It's very much a thing that's happening. It's affecting lots of people. And I think employers do need to grapple with, I guess, firstly encouraging staff to be able to feel that they are in a safe space and able to discuss these really difficult issues, which might impact their ability to do their job day to day, and they might need support, even though they might not know what form that support might take, but they might need to at least have those discussions. And I think there are certain employers that put their kind of themselves above the parapet and design specific pregnancy loss policies. We saw in the media, Monzo, Channel 4 taking those types of steps. There have been some critics out there saying that it shouldn't be so rigid or policy driven, and that actually your compassionate leave policy or other policies should be flexible enough to for that to, you know, miscarriages, other types of birth that aren't adequately legally protected to fall within those kinds of policies that already exist. But actually, you know, the counter argument to that is that actually sometimes employers need a specific policy to alert their mind to the specific issue, and make sure those people that are affected have adequate care and support that they need.
I think importantly, and the issue that the Cristiano Ronaldo situation has sort of shed light on is the fact that the father or partner, or you know, the person may not have suffered a miscarriage themselves, but have that still has a massive impact on them. So I think it's about broader. It's not just the sort of physical issue. There are, you know, it's the broader issue of how it impacts on both parents.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think actually, if I am recalling correctly, that for example, Channel 4's pregnancy loss policy offers 2 weeks paid leave for all employees who've been affected by pregnancy loss, yeah. And that includes partners and those with a surrogate mother, so it kind of brings into the fold all potentially affected, you know,
law firms introducing those. In fact, I just saw, I think Stevenson Harwood have just announced today that they're introducing a pregnancy loss policy. So there are lots of, you know, that it's happening, you know, in all sorts of sectors, and I think it's a really positive move, isn't it, to sort of, you say, to so that employers can't sort of do a sort of computer says no kind of response, because they have something, a sort of framework for giving the flexibility and the compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the current legal framework is lacking somewhat, in that, you know, there isn't currently a legal requirement for employers to pay miscarriage leave for a woman or her partner, because a miscarriage in the first 24 weeks of pregnancy isn't classed as childbirth. So in some companies, you could be in a situation where the only option for those who are affected is to take pregnancy-related sick leave, for which that individual would be paid a fraction of their normal wage, and that just might not be viable for them.
We're talking briefly about what happens post 24 weeks, isn't it? I think is what would have applied here, which is that if a child is born, if there was a stillbirth after that date, that the employees are entitled to their ordinary maternity and paternity leave and shared parental leave. All of those policies are triggered. So that you know, someone can take the full 52 weeks leave in those circumstances as they would with the live birth.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And also in 2020, there was the introduction of Jack's Law, which introduced statutory paid leave for bereaved parents. But again, that covers employees who have a stillbirth after 24 weeks of pregnancy. And it doesn't cover miscarriages, which, as we've said, happens, you know, if that happens before 24 weeks. There is some kind of provision for, you know, protection for people in these scenarios, but it doesn't necessarily cover everyone. So I think companies need to really think about what they can do to assist parents in those situations, and think about whether or not they need to make any. If the individual is able to speak about what they've gone through, you know, whether or not they need any support, any adjustments, or just general day-to-day support and ongoing kind of care from their colleagues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then I think we can move on to our third topic, which is Partygate. And this, I'm sure we'll all be well aware, but there was some noise recently around government seeking to delay a vote on launching an investigation into whether the Prime Minister misled Parliament over Partygate. I don't think I need to explain what Partygate is. I think we've all seen enough of it. But the MPs have now approved the Privileges Committee launching an inquiry once the police have finished their own investigations into the gatherings that occurred during lockdown. Governor had tried to delay the vote, but actually they made a U-turn following opposition from their own MPs. So just briefly to kind of go back into the facts, the Prime Minister had previously told MPs that laws weren't broken in Downing Street, leading to, as one would expect, accusations from opposition parties that the Prime Minister had misled them, given that he was recently fined for breaking COVID laws by attending an event in Downing Street to celebrate his birthday. His birthday actually, incidentally, is the same date as mine, and I spent mine abiding by the rules, but there we go. Under government guidelines, ministers who knowingly mislead the House of Commons are expected to resign. And the Privileges Committee, when they're able to launch their investigation, will investigate and produce a report stating whether or not they believe the Prime Minister did deliberately mislead Parliament. If they find that he did, they can recommend a sanction which could include suspension or expulsion from Parliament entirely. And they can also recommend that he apologises to the House. And then the MPs will then decide whether or not to approve the report and implement the recommended sanctions. So, Yulia, I was hoping to get your thoughts on this playing out and any kind of potential takeaways in, say, a more ordinary employment context in terms of this type of issue happening at the most senior level of leadership and what employers should do if something like this occurs.
Okay, thank you. In the employment law context, allegations of dishonesty are quite serious, especially if it applies to a regulatory framework. So if you work in the financial sector, for instance, your employer can actually report the matter to the respective regulator, and it can be taken further into another investigation. So in terms of employer and what measures they might take, they might consider whether they will need to carry out their own investigation into the matter, and they will need to consider whether to suspend the employee depending on the severity of the allegations. And they also need to consider timing, whether to wait for another investigation to conclude, whether there is a regulatory investigation or whether there is a criminal investigation, and whether to rely on the findings of that particular investigation.
I think just to mention on that is that obviously, as we know, Sue Gray's report has been held in abeyance until in this present context, until the police investigation is completed, and now obviously the Privileges Committee investigation will also be kind of pending that playing out. So I think there's a wider point here about managing concurrent investigations, and we see in our experience that that can be problematic. And I think employers need to be quite careful in how they go in terms of any delay that might bring about, and they'll need to think about various different factors. Do they need to really push through with this, with the workplace investigation, pending the police investigation going on? Are there, for example, is the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator, are they having to kind of be around each other day to day? Are there various different factors in play which mean that you need to kind of conclude the investigation as soon as possible? But then there's also, the other aspects that potentially, if you rush through with the employment investigation in the workplace, with the police investigation having not completed, you might be in a bit of a tricky situation there, because you have different standards of proof, for example. So in an employment situation, an investigator would be looking at whether or not the alleged conduct happened based on the balance of probabilities, whereas in the criminal context, there's a much higher threshold there, for it to be beyond reasonable doubt, for that conduct to be proved. So potentially you're in a situation where an independent investigator who might be, someone who with an HR background or whoever that might be, making a decision that has potentially really far-reaching implications for the individual. And practically, there are issues there as well with evidence potentially becoming contaminated, in that if you allow the workplace investigation to play out fully, then witnesses and the alleged victim, the alleged perpetrator, might then receive more information than they would ordinarily expect, i.e. through, you know, once the investigation report is completed, that might be accompanied by various different witness evidence, and they have that in front of them. So if then your criminal trial is, say, a year down the line, they've already seen all of that information, and they've potentially had time to kind of perfect their evidence before they even get to the criminal trial. So it can be really tricky, but it might not always be appropriate to wait until the police investigation has completed, because, as I say, it can take a really long time. So, but yeah, just to kind of mention how it can be tricky in practice.
Yes, absolutely. And as you mentioned, the legal standard of proof can be quite different as well. So it can happen that criminal investigations might conclude that there is no case to answer, but then there is enough evidence for employer actually to conclude otherwise in employment law context investigation, and potentially dismiss that person, especially if they consider that it has affected their ability to do the job. And also in terms of investigating senior members of employer, it's really important for employer to consider what kind of message they're going to send to the other employees. If they're going to brush the matter under the carpet, then potentially other employees might commit the same offence. And when it comes to question whether to investigate them or not, they might rely on what happened in the past. Might say, okay, you didn't investigate so-and-so, so you should not be investigating me too. And if the employer proceeds with the investigation and actually dismisses the person, they might have potentially planned for unfair dismissal. So it has to be really, really careful how employer treats the matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially when you're dealing with investigations into allegations that have been made against the kind of most senior individuals at an organisation. Obviously here, we've got the Prime Minister involved. It's in an ordinary employment context, you know, with senior leaders being investigated, there's a real emphasis on the importance of the investigation being independent and being carried out fairly and thoroughly, as one would expect, because of the message, as you say, Julia, the message that you want to be giving out to the rest of your employees, who will be looking carefully at how senior individuals are held accountable by the company or organisation that they're at. And, you know, the steps that are taken need to be appropriate, and that doesn't matter how senior that person is, they need to be leading from the top, so they also need to be held accountable too.
Absolutely.
I think that's the key thing, isn't it? That sort of leading from the top, and part of the problem, part of the reason we're in this kind of slightly sort of circular situation where there seems to be just sort of investigation after investigation, is that it's all about, you know, so many of the powers lie with the Prime Minister to, you know, to set the rules, set the standards, set the culture, and then you've got the sort of investigation and the you know, the allegations, the suggestion that Sue Gray might not be senior enough to make findings against someone, you know, someone who is obviously essentially her boss, and it's, you know, and it plays out a lot of the issues we see in practice in investigations, and the sort of, as you've already identified, that sort of concurrent criminal and civil investigations and how those sit alongside one another. But I think it just that that leading from the top is so key, isn't it?
So we will have to await the outcome of that, which I'm sure we'll be doing
all of the investigations, right? I mean, nothing's finalized yet. We haven't got the final outcome of the police investigation, we haven't got the final Sue Gray report, and then there's the privileges committee. So it's a lot of stuff.
We'll be waiting with bated breath. So thank you to Beth, Winnie and Julia for joining us today and discussing these really interesting news stories that we've seen in the last weeks or so. We hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of The Lawdown, and please do feel free to get in touch at any time by emailing us at info@cm-murray.com if you'd like any information on any of the topics that we've discussed, or in fact if you'd like to suggest a story for us to include in a future podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and we'll see you again next time.
Thanks a lot.